You're listening to At Any Rate, our global research podcast, where we take a look at the story behind some of the biggest trends, themes, and industries in markets today. I'm Matt Josoff, and I'm joined by Josh Younger and Nick Masunis to talk about mortgage convexity hedging in the current market. You two just put out a piece called A Mortgage Extends in a Forest, and I wanted to kind of delve into that a little bit more in light of some of the moves that we've seen in the market. So, Josh, can you tell us, I guess to start off, how do mortgage convexity events typically show themselves in both swap spreads, the basis, or implied vol even?
Sure. Thanks, Matt. So I guess maybe to quickly review, what do we mean by mortgage convexity events? And what we specifically mean is when rates are rising, for example, and the likelihood that mortgages are prepaid through refinancing goes down, their effective duration, their model duration increases. And so it's negative convexity in the sense that the duration of the asset increases as rates increase. And in a balanced portfolio where you have assets on the one hand, mostly mortgages, which are dynamic in their duration, and hedges on the other, say swaps or treasury futures, which are static or roughly static in their duration, then as the mortgages extend, there's this need to rebalance. So in the case of rising rates, one would need to make more negative the duration of the hedge portfolio to keep track with the extending mortgages. And so what that typically results in is swap spreads widening as rates rise. That's because many dynamic hedgers of mortgages use OTC derivatives and swaps in particular to accomplish that hedging. So you'll see directionality pick up, positive directionality, swap spreads wider as rates rise. Under normal, quote-unquote, circumstances, that directionality is negative. You'll also see implied vol rise because there's a tendency to try to buy back convexity through the options market. So you can buy an option to cover the negative convexity of the mortgage asset, either at the money or more often in high strikes. So that means vol is higher. It means payer skew richens. And sometimes another way to do this is to sell TBAs. So basically reduce mortgage exposure synthetically through the TBA market. And so you'll see the mortgage basis widen as well as rates rise. And all of these things were typical of prior convexity events. And the taper tantrum is what comes to mind most immediately. There's also 2003. But the key here is that active hedgers are what matter. And active hedgers means GSEs. It means mortgage REITs. It means certain mortgage servicers who have the same type of negative convexity exposure as pass-throughs. So, you know, the mortgage servicing asset itself is negatively convex as well. It's exposed to refinancing risk. So it's those three categories that we really focus on when we think about convexity risk. And we look for those signs in the market, and specifically in the interest rate derivatives market, so that we have a sense that this is actually happening.
Okay, so you mentioned 2003. Can you tell us a little more about what was so notable about that incident as well as the taper tantrum itself with respect to some of the biggest hedgers?
So the two examples of convexity events that we usually think of are 2003, this GSE extension trade, and the taper tantrum of 2013. So in 2003, the primary driver of this was Fannie and Freddie, who famously kept very tight duration gaps. That meant that even small changes in the duration of their assets was met with rebalancing in the hedge portfolio. And that's been true since, but what was really important in 2003 was simply the size of their retained portfolio. So the GSEs owned a significant fraction of the mortgage market. They hedged it with a very high frequency. They maintained a very tight duration gap. And that meant that moves in rates passed through very quickly to mortgage rebalancing type trades. And so we saw swap spreads widen 25, 30 basis points as rates rose. And that was a very substantial move. A lot of volatility in swap spreads. Vol was also much better. Was much better bid. So that's an example of the composition of the mortgage market mattering, who holds the mortgages and the investment and hedging strategy that that particular investor or investor group employs, in this case, the GSEs. Since then, the GSEs have gotten a lot smaller. And by 2013, they were a much smaller fraction of the market. And yet we saw another convexity event at the time, somewhat lesser in magnitude by certain measures. The optical extension of the index was greater, but the impact on interest rate derivatives markets was a bit less, although still dramatic. And that was a great example of certain investors being caught offsides and their risk position heading into the rise in rates, generating a convexity event, exacerbating its impact through the need to make up lost ground before you can try to keep pace with the rise in rates. And in this case, the REIT community was particularly important because they were running a rather long duration gap, something like 30 or 40 million a basis point. That's pretty large for them. they were quite large compared to their longer term history as well. So they were a big component of the market. More importantly, they were running this very long duration gap heading into a rise in rates. And the retained negative convexity of their portfolio, the unhedged negative convexity of their portfolio, was rather large as well compared to their history. So they were not hedging the prepayment risk in as high a fraction as they often do. And so that combination meant that even though they were a relatively small fraction of the overall mortgage market, their impact was much greater, both through the move in swap spreads and especially through the move in vol. So the change in implied volatility in 2013 was much greater than was the case in 2003. And that's, you know, in large part, or to no small part, due to REIT buying of option-based protection. So we can think of 2013 as a repricing in expectations triggered by a perceived shift in Fed policy, a broader market that was caught offsides and from a positioning standpoint, but a lot more fuel added to the fire from the activity of these relatively small in the context of the broader rates market, but very, very aggressive in their attempts to manage down risk, mortgage hedgers like the REITs, who were forced to keep pace and make up lost ground at the same time, leading to substantial volatility in both swap spreads and the pricing of options.
Okay, thanks, Josh. So switching to the mortgage side a bit, Nick, we've seen a big move in tens, about a 70 basis point move, and yet we really haven't seen a significant rebalancing from the mortgage community. Why do you think that's the case?
Right. So I think the main driver of mortgage prepays is actually the rate that faces borrowers, the primary mortgage rate. And one thing that was interesting in 2020 was how the primary mortgage rate didn't actually track the move in treasury yields. And we had, you know, a very small movement in that primary rate, a very small rally relative to the 150 basis point move that we saw in treasury yields. And the primary mortgage rate is determined kind of as a combination of a couple different spreads. You have the spreads between MBS and treasuries, that MBS basis. And then on top of that, you've got the primary and secondary basis, or the primary secondary spread. And, you know, the MBS treasury basis is relatively straightforward, just basically shows how attractive or rich mortgages are to treasury bonds. But then the primary secondary spread can be thought of as something different. It's not so much a valuation spread, so much as a measure of the capacity strain in the system. And so when we had that big rally last year, mortgage originators found that they were able to make enough loans to utilize their entire capacity and their entire pipeline without lowering their mortgage rates very much. Basically, they hit a level in mortgage rates that was enough to generate industry-wide capacity constraints. And as a result, that primary-secondary spread stayed very elevated at some of the highest levels it's ever been throughout most of the year. You know, typically rests around 100 basis points or so and got out to about 170, 180 basis points at its wide. And so as rates started to back up, treasury rates, that is, what we saw was that primary-secondary spread was actually compressing significantly as MBS secondary yields moved up, while the primary rate was actually drifting down slightly as originators were lowering their rates to pull in more volume. And in addition to that, thanks to the Fed sponsorship and great bank sponsorship of MBS this year, the spread between MBS and treasuries was also compressing. And so the net effect was that even though treasury rates backed up, you know, 70 basis points at this point, the lows in mortgage rates were actually seen right at the end of 2020, early 2021, and we're only, you know, 10 basis points or so off of those lows. We're at some of the lowest points. So basically, there hasn't been that big of a change in refinancing expectations because we haven't seen a move in the primary rate yet.
Okay, great. Thanks, Nick. So if we're not really seeing a lot of response right now in terms of rebalancing, Josh, do you think we're getting close to some kind of inflection point where convexity is going to start to matter?
So we're getting close to max negative convexity, but I think that is not necessarily the right thing to watch because, you know, as we learned in 2013, for example, REITs were a big part of the move, but not necessarily a big part of the dollar convexity and the duration delivery to the market. So what we really should focus on here is which investors are facing significant extensions and how are they likely to manage that risk? And among those active hedgers, the REITs, the GSEs, and the large bank servicers and others, there's really just not a lot of duration delivery, even in a 50 basis point move. So we're talking about something between $50 and $75 million a basis point, which at the end of the day is something the market can rather straightforwardly absorb. The more interesting case is that of commercial banks, which is something we focused on quite a bit over the past few months. And simply due to their size, the potential dollar duration, the risk delivery to the market in an extension trade would be much larger, something like $300 to $400 million a basis point, which if it were to all be hedged actively, would have a significant impact on a variety of different market observables and asset prices. The question is whether they're likely to do with that duration delivery. And this is where the ex-ante risk position of the potential hedger is really important. In the case of banks, as we've noted in the past, they're quite net short now, something like $1.5 trillion 10-year equivalents. So in the absence of significant hedging, that $350 million basis point would be welcomed as a risk balancing exercise. There's plenty of capacity to absorb that extension. In fact, it's risk reducing for bank balance sheets in aggregate. Now, there is the question of how much of that contraction in their balance sheet, that duration gap, has been already hedged. We can track their purchases of securities. It really doesn't move the needle that much. So their acquisitions of treasuries, while impactful on the pricing of swap spreads, has not significantly changed their duration position. But if we think back to the summer of 2019, there was very clear evidence that they were receiving in swap to cover this duration short that was emerging from the negative convexity, both of their assets and their liabilities, their mortgages and their deposits. So the question is, how much capacity is there to hedge that risk with swaps in an accounting-friendly way? And to do that, we can just look at their recognized floating rate assets. We can consider their syndicated term loans, their drawn revolver facilities, their commercial real estate loans with floating rate exposure, and to a lesser extent, credit card receivables and undrawn credit. And when you add all those things up, you can kind of get to a number around $500 million a basis point, which, while quite large, doesn't really bridge the gap. So when you're looking at, you know, $1.5 trillion of a short base to cover, and you get $500 back from hedging with your swaps, and you get $350 back from the extension of mortgage assets, there's still plenty of room. So the bottom line, without going into too much more arithmetic on a podcast, is to say at a high level, banks would welcome duration delivery through the extension of their mortgage assets rather than hedge it.
So I think it's interesting, though, that the banks have really evolved over time. And we've seen a big move from the big four banks to many of the non-banks in terms of servicing. And they don't actively hedge. So Nick, do you think that's something that could change down the road?
Yeah, it is possible that it could change. There is one non-bank that's a reasonable size that does actively hedge its MSR position, but it has kind of an outsized MSR position relative to its other revenue streams. And that other revenue stream for most non-banks is typically just refi activity. And so what we've seen over the past year is these non-banks have grabbed an increasing share of the total origination. You know, they now are about 75% of conventional GSE origination and nearly all of the Ginnie origination. And so the conventional banks are losing their servicing share of the overall market fairly rapidly at this point. So these non-banks are growing their MSR position. They've also gone public, at least a large number of them. Some of the biggest names have IPO'd, and as a result now have quarterly earnings that they need to meet. And some of them may at some point find that if they have a particularly volatile servicing asset, that may penalize them. However, in the short term, I think the most successful of them probably view their MSR asset as something of a business hedge, in that into a rally when their MSR asset would typically lose value because of its negative duration, that's when they're feasting on refi activity and they're actually able to grow their overall MSR book by just adding new borrowers because they're very good at that. And then into a backup in rates, you would see a lot of that refi activity subside and they'd lose some of that income, but the MSR book would gain in value. And so that might offset some of their business. So I think in the short term, it's unlikely that into the next, 50 basis point backup, they're going to change strategy and start hedging. But it is something to keep in mind as a possibility down the road. And then at that time, it's also interesting to think that they would just be beginning a hedging strategy. And so they would actually be needing to offset the negative duration of their MSR asset. So they'd be behaving differently than somebody who already has a stable, a hedged book might into other rate moves.
All right, great. Thanks. And I want to thank both of you, Josh and Nick, for sharing your thoughts on convexity in this pretty interesting market right now. Stay tuned for more episodes of At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast Series. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan Research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2021, JP Morgan Chase & Co. All rights reserved. This episode was recorded on February 12, 2021.